Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When you think about it, a lot of great music has come from people working in pairs. Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, Lieber and Stoller, and of course, Lennon-McCartney. A new book looks at how that dynamic between two people can produce amazing art, and later on the show we'll talk with its author. But we'll begin tonight's show with a more recent collaboration. This particular pairing consists of the singer and actress Idina Menzel and the composer Tom Kitt. They're both Tony Award winners. Tom Kitt is probably best known for his musical Next to Normal. And Idina Menzel, well, of course, she's known for originating the roles of Maureen in Rent and Elphaba in the musical Wicked. And she played a starring role in a little Disney movie called Frozen. But the two of them had never worked together until they teamed up on the Broadway musical If Then. And when Idina Menzel and Tom Kitt joined us on Soundcheck earlier this year, they began by performing a song from that show. It's called You Learn to Live Without.
You learn to take your coffee black. You learn to drink your whiskey neat. You learn to take the shower cold and sleep on tired feet. You learn to order dinner in. You learn to send the laundry out. You learn how to amuse yourself. You learn to live without. You tell yourself you're rich at last in money and in time. You draw a bath and then unplug the phone. You pour yourself a Pinot Clos Duval 2003. Tears and not to count the deadly days as they fade into years. You learn to stand alone at last, so brave and bold and strong and stout. You learn somehow to like the dark and even love the down. You learn to hold your life inside you and never let it out. You learn to die and then to live. You learn to live without. You learn to live without. You learn to live without.
That is Idina Menzel live on Soundcheck and Tom Kitt live at our piano with the song You Learn to Live Without. It comes from the musical If Then, which is playing now at the Richard Rogers Theater. The If Then original cast recording is now out. But Idina and Tom, good to have the two of you here with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Idina, let's start with just a kind of a practical question. There is a full cast on If Then.
Yes.
But you're singing for like 75-80% of this show.
Is that true, Tom? I don't know. Tom wrote all the music. I think,
a lot.
I sing a lot.
So, you know, that's a real kind of athletic feat, you know?
Use that word. That's how I think of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a voice teacher I've had for many, many, many years, ever since college. And, you know, we found our way to kind of learn how to build endurance and pace myself. And I warm up all the time. And then the more I sing, as long as I'm singing in a healthy, technically healthy way, then actually the stronger I get, as long as I don't get sick.
Well, now, that was going to be my next question. What happens if you get sick?
You make some bad sounds in front of a lot of people.
But there must be an understudy, right?
There's a wonderful understudy, yeah. Her name's Jackie Burns. But, you know, we don't like her to go on too much. I'm just kidding. There's an understudy, but, you know, there's a huge responsibility when your name's above the title, which is this is the first time for me that that's actually happened. So it's really hard for me to not go on. I got sick one time, and it's just my dedication and my pride and my will, my just desire to do the show whenever and however I can sometimes
gets the best of you.
Yes, and then I get out there and I wish I didn't.
Well, now you're playing two versions of this character Elizabeth, mm-hmm. and you know she's got a decision to make. It seems like a very minor decision, but it's mm-hmm. sort of like, you know, the butterfly flapping its wings
exactly.
that causes a tornado in Oklahoma or whatever
yeah.
it is. So it's all the spin-offs of this. And she becomes Liz in one story.
Uh-huh. Her name's Elizabeth. And in one story, she feels more connected to Liz, the other Beth. And she's sort of, you know, I don't know. I think of her as one soul with two different experiences mm-hmm. that we're following and how the circumstances of her life affect who she becomes.
And does the music sort of, you know, parallel the different stories? I mean, Tom,
yes.
when you guys were writing the music, does Liz's music have maybe a different cast, a different sound from Beth's music?
Well, I did try to create two specific themes for the two tracks. When they start out, you hear them in the overture before the show begins. And since they're coming from the same person, they wanted to have a similarity to them. But I find one has a little more of a searching romantic quality to signify which character is going to meet the guy mm-hmm. early on. And another one is sort of a little more life choice and career quality to me. But, you know, it's really about the events in their life that shape the kinds of songs and the moods they're in.
But it's so multi-layered what he's done with the music. And it's probably for some people on a subconscious level, maybe for other musicians, they'd really hear it. But there's just so many layers there that help me as an actor as well. It's that sometimes there's not as much work as you think, because if I just sort of float on top of what he has, you know, he speaks to me, sort of tells me the core, what Beth is feeling in this or Liz. And I offered to sing Beth as an operatic singer and Liz as a jazz singer, but we thought that was too on the nose.
Well, now that sort of gets to another interesting thing about If Then, which is, now, Tom, it's you and Brian Yorkey,
yes.
the lyricist, and you guys have won a Pulitzer Prize for doing Next to Normal.
Mm-hmm.
How early on was Idina involved in the kind of creation of this?
Idina was on board very early. We knew after Next to Normal that Brian and I wanted to do our next project with Michael Greif, and David Stone talked to us about doing our next show. And we were floating around different ideas. And when If Then came to David, David said, well, actually, Idina and I have been talking about doing something. And I think this might be something she would be interested in. And as soon as that came to us, we thought that would be a dream come true to work with her.
So that gives you the opportunity not just to write in a vacuum, but to know the major character, the major actor for whom you're writing.
Yes, it's very helpful. It's very daunting when you have a talent like Idina Menzel to do her justice, and it is. You want to write?
Snorted.
I know you did, and I
think we all heard that, Idina.
But you do. It's you want to really do justice to that gargantuan instrument, and certainly for me, I even have memories, pictures of me sitting at the piano, hearing her voice in my head as I was writing the first songs.
So, Idina, it's another character that you were the original Maureen in Rent, mm-hmm. and Elphaba in Wicked, and here you are creating this kind of dual character mm-hmm. here. I mean, is that something that you set out to do, or have you just gotten really, really lucky?
Both. Definitely both. I think Rent was my first professional job, and it was an original musical, and I was involved pretty early on, and I saw how wonderful a process and experience, what a wonderful process it is to stand by the piano with Jonathan Larson at the time, and I learned just how incredibly grateful an actor could be to stand there and sort of be invited into these artists' sanctuary, you know, and have them doing their creative thing. So I always knew what an honor it was to be a part of that. And then it happened again years later with Wicked. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten lucky, but also I try to seek out working with people on brand new material. It just takes a lot longer. You know, people say, why haven't you come back to Broadway in so long? These things take a while to really develop and, you know,
and you're there in the process of the creation of the songs and the story.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Know. I mean, they have their space. I'm not hanging over them or anything. But as soon as he has something he's excited about, he comes and we go to the piano and we try it out. And mm-hmm. you know, and I think there's the chicken or the egg sometimes. You yeah. know, and that's what's so lovely about it.
Now it is the role of Elizabeth, this kind of dual role. It's fairly emotional, you know. So you seem to be kind of emotionally invested in it.
Uh-huh.
Is it tough to do that night after night?
Yes. Yes. But you start to, I don't know if it's the creature of 8 shows a week or what it is, but you learn a way to protect yourself, and you learn a way to that your body feels it when the lights are on and the music starts, and you also learn that when you walk off, you can go call your son and laugh with your castmates about something funny that happened. And for me, I wouldn't be able to survive if I had to do that all day long and be entrenched in the character.
Yeah.
So, but at first it's not like that. At first you have to find those things. Then they start to click in because you do them every day.
Now, so we follow Liz and we follow Beth through their parallel but different life courses. And it all hinges on, you know, who she goes with. Does she go with mm-hmm. this person, or does she go over there and listen to the guitarist, you know,
right.
follow the career, follow the music?
Yeah.
We, on Soundcheck, about a year ago, had the author Laurie Carson on, and she'd written a book called The Original 1982
mm-hmm.
about a woman who has the same choice to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does she have a kid, or does she follow a musical career? And it seems like, you know, especially for women, that this is often like a choice that somebody faces.
I've faced it. I continue to face it, you know. That's why when you talk about these dual character, I know that is what it seems, but it's for me, or for most women, I think it's just different parts of the spectrum that we're highlighting to tell a story about. You know, I mean, they're all me, they're all of us, and yes, I've struggled with putting off having a child, worried that it would distract me from my ambition and my career. And then I realized once I had a child how that enriched my life and me as an artist and as a woman. And it's constant, the balancing motherhood now with my performing and my career and the guilt that I'm constantly slaying myself with. And it's just – but it's wonderful to have a role, a show that I can at least go and assess those things mm-hmm. and work through them on stage. I'm very lucky.
Now, the other thing is the moment of choice. You don't always know when that is.
Exactly,
you know, sometimes
yeah.
it takes a few years and you look back and say, oh, that's where.
If I would have picked up the phone, yeah.
So is there a moment in your career where, you know, looking back on it now, you say that was the moment where I made the decision that set me on this path?
I guess Rent is one of those moments for me because Michael Greif is our director from MIFDEN, and he's the one that really discovered me 18 years ago, whenever it was. And I was also really I wanted to be a singer-songwriter rock star at the time, and I didn't think I wanted to go into theater, even though as a kid that's all I listened to. I just didn't know who I was and what to do with my voice and my artistic identity, you know. And but I went in anyway, and then I met him, and then here we are today, just continuing to work on these projects. And it's not just about the projects; it's about the support system and the family. And the older you get, you realize it's more about the people you spend your time with, and who you pick to teach you and to challenge you. And so I'm just so glad that I made that decision to go in that day to that audition.
You ever wonder what would have happened if the decision had gone the other way, if you decided not
to? Yeah, that's something that we think about a lot in this show is, if you didn't make that decision, would it still come back around? What is meant to be? Yeah. What is destined? What is all just chance? And some statistics, life statistics, mm-hmm. you know, the probability of. And I believe deep in my heart, I'm not a very religious person, but I do feel that things, maybe it would take me a longer journey or I'd come back around. However, you know, you have to learn these lessons. You have to experience these things in your life to be prepared for the next door to open. And whichever way that works out, it would have some sense to it.
Idina Menzel and Tom Kidd here with me in the Soundcheck studio. The musical If Then is playing now at the Richard Rodgers Theater. And Tom, without giving anything away, what Idina is just talking about, the idea that, you know, things will come around mm-hmm. at some point, you know, that the universe will revolve if it's meant to and put you in a certain place, it does become part of the storyline of If Then, right?
Yeah, that was one of the central themes that Brian and I talked about when we first decided we were going to write this. The central question of are you meant to meet the person of your dreams? Are you meant to meet the love of your life? And Brian, I think, hilariously says that from time to time, if it's a musical, the answer is yes.
Otherwise, you don't have much of a musical,
exactly.
do you? All right. Brian Yorkey is the lyricist, and Tom Kidd, of course, wrote the music. So do you guys want to do another song for us?
Sure.
All right. So Tom's going to make his way back to the piano, and Idina Menzel to the microphone. The song is called Some Other Me, and, of course, you'll find it on the original cast recording of If Then, which is out now. If Then is playing now at the Richard Rodgers Theater. We'll hear both Idina Menzel and Tom Kitt in this song called Some Other Me, live on Soundcheck.
Somewhere there's a world where you and I are man and wife. We have a child. We're three, and it's just fine with me to love that life. And somewhere there's a world where from the first we never met, we never spoke or kissed. We don't know what we missed or don't know yet. And I didn't go to Vassar, but to Smith or Yale or Brown. I ended up in Boston or some small Alaska town to practice law or neuter cats or fish the Bering Sea. Those lives are lived somewhere by some other me. Some other me is homeless. Some other me is queen. Some other me has seen things that no other me has seen. If I met her, I would ask her that one question we both fear. Some other me. How do we end?
there's a me who never loved that other you who liked your fine, I guess, as buddies, more or less. And that would do. And somewhere there's a you who simply worshipped other me, and we were wild and hot, and all the things were not, and we were free. And somewhere I'm the president with plans that never fail, and somewhere I'm a rebel king, and somewhere I'm in jail. I didn't chase my glory days long after they were done. I found myself a woman or a man and had a son. Some other me is a rock star. Some other me still cool. Some other me does not feel like some tired old fool. And you and I are strangers, or we're lovers, or we're not. The other me's live with what they've got.
Look down each road left untaken.
Trace every turn and twist.
The lives that we just let go by.
The dreams we might have missed.
Now we're old enough to know that one road ends where one begins. The moment where the what might be turn into might have been.
There's a world where you and I can still be friends, not like we were, not yet. We forgive but don't forget. No happy ends, but
Some Other Me is the name of the song from the musical If Then, with lyrics by Brian Yorkey and music by Tom Kitt. Idina Menzel singing live here in the Soundcheck studio. Tom Kitt doing some singing, too.
Isn't he amazing?
He did pretty well. That's Anthony Rapp's part, right?
That is, yes.
So that's who sings it on the original cast recording, but Tom's singing it here in the studio. Not bad for a Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning musician and pianist and composer. Now, the two of you and the rest of the crew on If Then had a somewhat unusual problem. And as problems go, this is a good one to have. This is like, where am I going to put all this beer? It's
right.
That, you know, with Idina now drawing in so many fans, Tom, especially mm-hmm. younger ones, you guys have written a very adult show here.
Ah, interesting mm-hmm. question.
So how do you... I mean, Idina, you look out in the audience and you see, you know, a row of 10-year-old girls, and you're singing a song whose title could be reduced to WTF.
Yes.
How do you deal with that?
Well, they actually say the certain age. I forget what it is.
I think it's 12. I think we say 12 and up for the show.
Well, you say that, but...
No, but really, there are not many little girls in blue dresses sitting out in If Then.
It's a wonderful problem to have that so many people want to come see Idina and come see the show. I actually brought my 9-year-old to the mm-hmm. invited dress because it's funny how when you're a parent, you find yourself clinging to your child for support much more than your child actually clings to you. And I wanted him there that night. And what he got, he got. I'm not saying bring 9-year-olds, but the show resonates. And I think we wrote it not knowing that Frozen was going to be what it was.
We also have found, not to denigrate the older people that come, but the younger people are very smart and with it, and they get a lot of stuff, and they enjoy the puzzle, putting the puzzle together of the show. Maybe because... I don't know why, but it's turned out
because
to not
they're
be as
young,
much.
Because they're
young, because
they're not
know,
beaten down by life.
It's also with all the technology today, the kind of puzzle pieces of the show, I think, are attractive to people whose minds are thinking that way and have had grown up with that kind of technology as well.
But it's not as much of a problem. Actually, when I do my concerts, my private concerts, that's when I worry more because, you know, people will come to bring their kids to hear Let It Go, and I'm 43 years old, and I've got stories to tell, you know, that aren't necessarily appropriate, and I don't know how to do it so that I'm respectful but also true to myself.
Right. So the fanzels, as they're known, your enormous army of fans, they come to these concerts as well?
Yeah, but the fanzels could be, you know, 30-year-old women, guys now, and you know, they're from Rent back
right,
then.
That's true.
So it depends on what generation you're talking about, and that's what I'm so proud of, and what I feel so grateful for is that each project has been in a decade, so that people come back, and as they have children, then they bring them. And
so what you're saying is there are now three generations.
Hopefully,
of
yeah. So that when I'm 70, I'll still have a musical someone will want to write for me.
I'll write that musical.
We're speaking with Idina Menzel and Tom Kitt, star and composer, respectively, of the Broadway musical If Then, playing now at the Richard Rodgers Theater. Idina, what kind of name is that, Idina? I-D-I-N-A. I've never seen
it's
that.
Obviously a name that doesn't get pronounced very easily. No,
has not been heard on Oscar night all that often.
Not really, no. it's an Israeli name, a Hebrew name. It means gentle. I'm not Israeli. I'm Jewish.
Are you
and
gentle?
My mom, and I can be very gentle. Yeah, it depends who you ask, I guess. Yeah, and I was named after my great-grandmother, Ida. And my mom, in Jewish religion, when someone passes, you name after, use the first letter. And
right.
So, but we don't, my mother, my whole life said it's not Idina, it's Idina, a short I. But, you know, if anyone, everyone in Long Island that I grew up with calls me Idina. So if I hear someone call me on the street from behind, they say it like that, I know it's someone from high
school.
From school,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So how does a good Jewish girl from Long Island end up doing a Christmas album?
All the good Jews do Christmas albums.
That's true.
That's
true.
Just a time-honored tradition.
True.
Yes, that's what I've told myself. Barbara did one.
Barry Manilow.
Yes, and Irving Berlin, right, and all these amazing writers. And so I told myself it's okay. I am going to have a little bit of... I told myself it's okay, and I'm enjoying making it. These are the most beautiful songs. The melodies are incredible. Yeah. And a good Jewish girl from Long Island likes to make a Christmas tree. Now, it might not be that many colors. It might be all, you know, white lights with, you know, it's very color coordinated, and a Jewish American princess's Christmas tree, but I still do the tree.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Idina Menzel, Tom Kitt, it has been a lot of fun having you guys here with us in the
Thank
studio.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sung by a choir and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
That's Idina Menzel's version of the Christmas song from her latest album, Holiday Wishes. You can watch video from our live session with Idina Menzel at soundcheck.org. And we want to remind you, if you like what you hear on Soundcheck, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you really, really like what you hear, just leave us a review in the iTunes store. Up next, we talk with an author whose book aims to debunk the myth of the lone creative genius and instead focuses on the power of creative pairs. Stay with us. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Mandolin player Chris Thiele, pianist Vijay Iyer, cellist Elisa Weilerstein, all musicians who've received what's known as the Genius Grant, or a MacArthur Fellowship, in the past few years. The idea of people as geniuses has existed for centuries. Single people who stand out for their brilliance or ingenuity in a particular field. But a new book aims to broaden that scope and take a look not at the solitary genius, but at creative pairs. Joshua Wolf Schenk is the author of that book called Powers of Two, And he joins me here in the studio. Josh, welcome.
Thanks.
So the idea of the creative pair, I mean, I think immediately of John and Paul.
Yeah.
And in fact,
as
your
did
book,
I.
As your book starts with the story of them writing a song together. What is it about John Lennon and Paul McCartney that makes them sort of iconic in this way?
Yeah. Well, there's the work, which, you know, is just now woven into the DNA of our culture, and it's amazing. My 8-year-old nephew a couple years ago, the first thing he wanted to put up in his room when he was decorating it was a Beatles poster.
Wow.
So it just goes on and on. And they light up all the themes of creative pairs, starting with their meeting. Paul wandered under the fields behind this church in Liverpool, and he'd heard that there was a band playing. His friend said, come check him out. And he saw this guy on stage. He was doing a Del Viking song, which is classic doo-wop, and he was vamping to the lyrics, making up the lyrics as he went along, and making it into a blues song. And he even used the word penitentiary, which a scholar says that that's not a word that you would use
in England.
In the UK. Yeah, it was like, that's the American South there. And he was really impressed. And then they went across the road, and the Quarrymen had another gig that night, so there was some time to sit around.
This is John Lennon's early band.
That's right. And Paul picked up his guitar and flipped it around. Actually, it's not clear if it was Paul's guitar or someone else's guitar. Anyway, he flipped it around to play it left-handed, which was also super impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And he started doing his thing, and he could do Little Richard perfectly, and he could do Carl Perkins perfectly. He could, he was this perfect mime. He could just inhabit these things, and he knew the lyrics. And even the fact that he knew the Del Viking song lyric, and he knew that John was screwing with it, was a sign of his mastery. And these guys, the chemistry was palpable. One of the other members of the band said they were circling each other like cats.
Yeah. So, and you write that it's not just that they kind of shared interest and knowledge. They shared a kind of deep subset of knowledge, stuff that most other kids their age in England at that time did not know.
Yeah, both these guys, when Heartbreak Hotel came on the radio, this was life-changing for them. This was like, it opened up their whole world. And they went deep, deep, deep down, each in their own particular way. I mean, John was full of swagger and energy, and he wanted to make things his own. Paul was much more meticulous. So they had these, you know, points of tension from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and this really profound alignment. They were also, you know, both extremely ambitious and wanted to be, you know, big characters in the world, and made themselves so.
So you start off the book, again, it's called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. You start off, it's an afternoon in 1967.
Yeah.
And John and Paul are sitting together in Paul's house.
That's right, yeah, in London.
And they are writing a song.
Yeah.
This song. The song is, of course, With a Little Help from My Friends, Ringo singing, but John and Paul have written this song together in Paul's room. And as you tell the story, Josh, Paul has an opening line. You know, Paul has the line, do you believe in love at first sight? But it's not quite right. It doesn't scan properly. And John tweaks it. And
It was the other way that John had this idea that they could begin the verses with a question, or he threw out a question, and Paul said, maybe we could begin every verse that way. Do you believe in love at first sight? And he was like, you know, it's kind of there. It's not quite right. He tried to break it up. It didn't have the right number of syllables. And Paul said, how about, do you believe in a love at first sight? Which is just the tiniest thing.
Yeah.
And but this is it's the tiny things, this tiny exchange out of which, you know, these great works emerge. And the scene, we have really intimate access to the scene because Hunter Davies, who was writing a book about the guys and hung around them a lot, they really trusted this guy and they let him sit in the studio and watch them work. He was there the whole time. They got together in the afternoon, which was their custom. And they would kind of work through to the early evening or mid-evening when they would go to Abbey Road, and they would often be there all night. And there's this description the hunter gives of the two of them there in the room as they got started, and they're banging around. John's with his guitar and Paul is with his piano, and he says, for a couple of hours, they both banged away. Each seemed to be in a trance until the other came up with something good. Then he would pluck it out of a mass of noises and try it himself. So you have this really, to me, you know, spine-tingling sense of two guys who are totally alone and totally together all the while. And that's one of the magical things about a pair, is that it allows for enormous solitude, enormous individuality, and also this possibility of connection.
My guest is Joshua Wolf Schenk, author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. We lionize the solitary genius, but genius does come in these kind of dyads, you know, these two artists orbiting each other. Very often, two guys, I mean, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, they had a kind of, for a while, a romantic relationship as well as an artistic one. But it seems like most of these relationships are non-romantic. How heavily weighted towards dudes is this thing?
Well, you know, there's a huge missing story in our culture around what women have contributed to creative work, because for so long, you know, there was this expectation that, you know, the wife or the woman on a scene would contribute to her husband's work, and it would take his name, and she was, you know, that was just that was her role, to be totally hidden.
And we would dismiss this with the old phrase, behind every great man there's a woman.
Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, it's a cliche that needs to be dug into, and like, we need to get under the soil of that and actually bring it up, because if you look, for instance, at the story of George Lucas and Marcia Lucas in Star Wars, absolutely critical. The contribution she made, the back and forth, she was the only person when they got into the heart of that who could say, no, George, you know, stand up to him. And there are many specific ideas you can trace to her. She was a very talented film editor.
I was just going to say, she was not just his wife.
Exactly right. But where is she in the official history of Star Wars? You know, where is she in the popular consciousness? Almost zero. And that is a built-in problem for my book, because so many of these stories have been lost, many of them were never recorded to begin with. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do a proper history, but I hope as we start talking about it that more and more of them will emerge, because it's a really, really important part of the story.
As you tell the story of all these different creative pairs, you know, whether it's in the world of technology or literature or in music, it almost seems inevitable that most of these pairs will at some point fly apart, that the same thing that keeps them together, that tension, will eventually push them apart.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I have these wood candlesticks at home, and at a certain point it burns down, the flame will burn down the fuel of the candle, and it'll get to the wood. You better blow it out before it gets there. And that seems like a good image. I'm the numbskull who often forgets that it burns down to the wood, and it does happen. People do get singed, and you put it just right, that there's something essential to creativity that involves conflict and energy and two people coming at each other, and it does have a natural lifespan. Sometimes people really just need a break from each other, mm-hmm. and then they can come back at it. And if you look really carefully at the denouement of John and Paul, that was not a final split. They needed space from each other, and there was an enormous amount of desire that, you know, all the way through the rest of John's life, and moments when it really seemed like they were about to work together again, and the circumstances just didn't come together. There were lots of practical reasons and, of course, emotional reasons why it didn't happen. But when John came back to music in the late 70s, he was not only intending to do this thing he did with Yoko, but to get back together with Paul, and he hoped that George would come along too. They had active plans for that kind of reunion.
So when we talk about the dissolution of these creative pairs, very often there are some kind of external factors. I mean, they're sort of woven into the pair itself. I'm thinking of David Crosby and Graham Nash as an example. You know, David Crosby's drug problem really at some point becomes more than the creative tension can hold together.
Yeah.
And you tell the story, tell the story of what the breaking point for them was.
Yeah, I'll tell the story as they told it to me. It's, it's just the iconic thing that, you know, Nash was and is an extremely patient guy. He loved he loves David, and he loved working with him. They bring out something very unusual in each other. And even though there have been a trio, obviously, and a foursome with Neil Young, those guys really regard each other as, you know, as their primary partner, and they've often done stuff as a duo and contribute to each other's work, solo work. And Crosby, you know, Nash loved that Crosby was the kind of guy who would say screw you to the world. He didn't care what other people thought, and he opened him up, and he loosened him up, and Nash had this, you know, the pure, perfect pop structure of those songs. He brought that to the partnership, but Crosby, you know, got really strung out, and Nash put up with it for as long as he could, but there was this disastrous session when they got together, and they were starting to jam, and things were really heating up, and it felt really good. And Crosby had brought his crack pipe into the studio and put it on one of the speakers. And it's like, you know, this big full session jam, mm-hmm. and the speakers are shaking, and the crack pipe is moving closer and closer to the edge, and suddenly it falls over the edge and cracks. Crosby stopped the jam, went over, and starts trying to pick up and put together the pieces of this broken pipe. And Nash says, that was it. I knew we were done. I couldn't work with this guy anymore, because and the way he expresses it is really moving to me, because it wasn't exasperation with Crosby himself, which of course he felt. It was that the music had always been sacred between the two of them, that they were about something bigger than either one of them, and that if Crosby didn't have faith in that, and he could not serve that, and he could not let the two of them serve it together, well, then Nash was done. But it's also really moving, because they tell the story, and you're like, okay, you want to flash forward many years till Crosby was out of rehab. But in fact, if you look at the chronology, there was no getting away from each other. They were too bound up in each other, and it was really only months later that Nash was putting together this No Nukes concert, and he really didn't want to work with Crosby or Stills. He wanted this to be this other thing. And the guys came to him. They said, "Man, we need another act. You know, we need another headliner." And he called them up. And of course, you know, they were on a plane and they did the show.
Josh, you mentioned in the book that even though Stephen Stills is part of the equation, Crosby and Nash really they considered themselves as a creative partnership.
Yeah, they did, and they do. I asked them. Many pairs have a private language that evolves organically over time. You know, it starts with little. In you know jokes or you know little phrases, and I asked the two of them. We were in a hotel room before a CSN gig, and I said, "Do you guys have a private language?" And they were like, "Oh yeah, we do." They said, one of them said, well, "Ask Stephen about that," and the other one said, "Do not ask Stephen about that." They're you know he's a great colleague. They love his work, but those guys are bonded in a really really profound way, and you know they show up all through. You know, all through you know recent pop history. If you listen to Mexico, it's the two of them in the back. You know, as a you know unit, and they even I saw them not long ago in L.A. And Nash was talking about a record he did. He said it was our first solo album, and he goes, "I mean, our first album as just as Crosby and Nash." But that he said, you know, he caught himself and he recognized that's the way he thinks that they're one unit.
So is, at the end of the day, is there something specific to the duo that you don't get with when you add a third or a fourth person? Is there a kind of genius that is specific to the duo?
It's an unusual unit, the pair, because it's a social unit and we're social creatures and we really, to create a reality, we need another person, not necessarily in the room with us, but we need to be in relation in some way with another person, and yet it's immensely fluid and flexible. You can take roles, you can switch roles, you can have solitude, you can have connection. The moment a third person comes in, the dynamic changes, and it can be very helpful. I mean, John and Paul, there's a reason why they had George there too and Ringo there too, and they were something beyond what they could do alone with that third and fourth. But they, as Jeff Emmerich said, who's the engineer, worked for them all those years, he said, the artist was Lennon and McCartney, and George played a critical role, but it was much more of a supportive role. And actually, if you look at the end story, again, everyone wants to know what happened to John and Paul in the end. A lot of what happened is that George, who had been this very stable, supportive presence, kind of doing what needed to be done to polish and dress up this music and had been a journeyman songwriter himself, he got fed up with it. He didn't want to be the little brother anymore. He wanted to do his own work, and he was starting to record, to write and record these, you know, these sublime songs. And that that shifted things so that this constant kind of give and take between John and Paul could no longer had the structure it once had.
And the book is called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. My guest has been Joshua Wolf Schenck. He is the author of that book, Powers of Two. And Josh, it's been a real pleasure having you with us.
Oh, so much fun.
Up next, it's our series, That Was a Hit, about unlikely and sometimes just plain awful chart successes. I'll leave it to you to decide which category the subject of our next installment falls into. It's coming up right after the break. This is Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Our series, That Was a Hit, is all about those head-scratching songs that have occasionally made their way to the top of the pop charts. And today, we're looking at not one, but two big hits from the singer known as Fergie. And here with me in the studio, once again, is pop chart columnist Chris Malanfi. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John.
Why are you doing this?
I'm asking myself that same question because, you know, we've been doing That Was a Hit for, what, a couple of years now?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've come on here and done a number of songs that, while improbable, are not at all hateful, right? I decided today we should just do a couple of songs I personally can't stand. And I don't think I'm alone on this one. So, yeah, we're doing a doubleheader by Fergie.
All right. Now, Fergie, you know, her music career gets going when she joins the Black Eyed Peas.
That's right. Although she'd had a bit of a career as far back as the 90s. She was briefly in a pop act from the late 90s called Wild Orchid. Her name, full name, Stacey Ferguson. But basically, both her career and the Black Eyed Peas' career was reinvented when she joined the Black Eyed Peas in 2003. It was a boost for her, and it was a huge boost for them.
Right. So the album Monkey Business comes out, and it, you know, has a bunch of singles that do really well. But the one that surprises everybody and the one that does the best of all of them is the execrable My Humps.
What you gonna do with all that junk inside your trunk?
I'ma get you drunk, get you love drunk off my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my hump, my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my lovely little lumps. Check it out.
Let's talk about My Humps. So,
if you insist.
Yeah, My Humps was the third single promoted from the second post-Fergie Black Eyed Peas album called Monkey Business, as you mentioned. They'd already had a couple of pretty big hits. They'd had a song called Don't Funk With My Heart, which was a top 10 hit. And this is the interesting part. The label was promoting a second single called Don't Lie, and it was climbing up the top 40. It had edged its way into the top 20. But simultaneously, further down on the Hot 100, the Billboard chart, was another song called My Humps. It's a song from the album that, unlike all the prior Black Eyed Peas hits that featured Fergie sort of in a supporting or a hype girl role, if you will, she is absolutely center stage. The other Black Eyed Peas are almost an afterthought in this song. It feels, with 2020 hindsight, like the staging ground for Fergie's solo career. But frankly, it also sounds like a total novelty record. I mean, it's kind of a goof. I mean, if I'm being charitable, parts of it are amusing. I mean, if you regard it as some kind of satire, I'm not sure how deeply satirical it is. But it's at least a little funny. But it doesn't sound like the first song you reach for when you're looking for a radio hit. And what was crazy was that it was climbing the charts on its own. And an important detail is that all this was happening in 2005, which was the year Billboard added digital sales like iTunes sales to its Hot 100 chart, which has, you know, been around for decades. And that was an important detail because it meant that the public could vote more directly for singles than they ever could before. And they were buying the song. The label wasn't even pushing it that hard yet. And it was rising on the charts largely because people were going to iTunes and for 99 cents a piece buying My Humps. And it was climbing. It was already in the top 40 while the label was still promoting the second single, Don't Lie.
So the what was the catchphrase? My lovely lady?
Yeah. My lovely lady lumps. Yes. If you think that, you know, we're in 2014 right now, folks, and there's a lot of songs about booty on the radio right now. And if you think we're body obsessed this year, I mean, yeah, My Humps, you can kind of thank that for some of what we've been seeing on the charts in the last 9-10 years.
You're my love, my love, my love, my love. You love my lady lumps. My hump, my hump, my hump. My humps, they got you.
She's got me spending.
Oh, spending all your money on me and spending time on me.
She's got me spending.
Oh, spending all your money on me.
A little bit of My Humps, a surprise hit for the Black Eyed Peas, featuring Fergie from their hit record Monkey Business. The surprise being that this was not one that the record company had identified. We're going to push this, make... This was people going on iTunes and turning this thing into a hit.
They just gravitated toward it, yeah. Probably for the comedy as much as anything.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Do you think, you know, people were listening to this and saying, wow, what a funny song?
I think that's probably right. I mean, you know, the Hot 100 has had an illustrious history of, you know, number one hits or top 10 hits that are novelties. I mean, you know, we had The Fox last year and we had, you know, going all the way back to Chipmunk songs in the 50s. And this really read as goofy novelty, but it really caught the public's attention. The label switched gears. The second single, Don't Lie, never even made it into the top 10. And they shot a video for the song, began pushing it really hard. It wound up peaking at number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 and spent more time on the charts than any single from that album.
And just became like a cultural trope. You know, people would quote
totally.
The lines from it on TV shows and stuff. And it does, as you say, in 2020 hindsight, does seem to be the launching pad for Fergie's solo career, which brings us to the second part of your doubleheader today on That Was a Hit.
Yeah, so just 1 year later, in the late summer of 2006, the onslaught of Fergie's solo career begins. You know, using the momentum from the last Black Eyed Peas album, they launch her solo album, The Duchess, with a song that went to number one. It was actually the first of 3 number one hits from that album and the first of 5 top 5 hits. I mean, this album did very well and spun off a lot of hits. But the song I want to focus on is a song that went to number one in the late summer of 2006 called London Bridge. And I want to talk about this because I kind of can't believe it went to number one. And I don't even think it's terribly well remembered now. Like, there are other number one hits like Big Girls Don't Cry, which whatever you think of it does get played on adult contemporary radio to this day. But I'll be darned if I've even heard London Bridge since it went to number one in the summer of 6.
You're certainly not going to hear it on adult contemporary radio.
That's for sure.
Kind of a... There's no double entendre.
It's a
here.
Single entendre, yeah. The lyrics are pretty insipid. It's kind of Hollaback Girls for Dummies. I mean... Fergie, love you long time. How come every time you come around my London, London Bridge, want to go down? In case you all are wondering why the song is called London Bridge, it's not an ode to a, you know, great cultural landmark. It's a really thin metaphor for sex. It's pretty bad.
When I come to the club, step aside. Pop the seats, don't be heavy in the line. VIP, because you know I got a shot. I'm Fergie Ferg, give me love you long time. All my girls get down on the floor. Back to back, drop it down real low. I'm such a lady, but I'm dancing like a... Because you know I don't give up, so here we go.
Fergie with London Bridge, Oh Snap, from her huge album called The Duchess. And Chris Melanfi, who often joins us on Soundcheck in our series That Was a Hit, bringing us a Fergie two-headed edition of That Was a Hit today. What is it that surprises you about this becoming a number one hit?
I think the thing that I guess offends me most as a chart fan is the pop charts. You know, the Hot 100 is kind of my sports. I follow the Hot 100 the way people follow their favorite team. And when I'm behind a song, I root for that song. And the thing that really kind of ticks me off about London Bridge is that in the summer of 2006, it prevented easily the best song of that year and what some people argue is the best song of the 2000s, that decade, from going to number one. I'm talking about Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. This song went to number one, Crazy had been parked at number two on the Hot 100, stuck behind the biggest summer hit of that year, Promiscuous by Nelly Furtado. And they were saying that, oh, with just a few more points, Crazy was going to go to number one. And everybody had already written about how awesome Crazy was. It had been covered by dozens of artists, and everybody was talking about it. It felt like the song of the year. And for it to go to number one would have just, you know, made it one of those classic songs that was both the a big hit of the year and, you know, a classic. And in comes Fergie. It went to number one, the London Bridge song, in 3 weeks. It leapt from, like, the lower rungs of the chart to number five, and then jumped to number one, blocking Crazy, which got stuck at number two. So it's just kind of doubly offensive. It's like a pretty terrible song that blocked an unbelievably great song from going to number one. And that just drove me insane.
But, you know, I think in hindsight, what do we remember from that year? We remember Crazy.
Absolutely.
You know, Gnarls Barkley, that is a song that seems like it has legs.
I mean, Rolling Stone named it its greatest song of the aughts. So, yeah, I mean, Crazy has a pretty solid legacy.
But it never hit number one because of Fergie and London Bridge. And that was a hit. Chris Melanfi, good to have you back.
Thank you, John.
I remember when I lost my mind.
Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with Jimmy Page, the renowned guitarist from Led Zeppelin. We'll talk about his new photographic autobiography, his extensive guitar collection, and what's hiding in his personal music vault. Plus, we'll have live music from the blues rock singer-songwriter Benjamin Booker. Now, if you haven't heard him yet, go look him up on the internet right now and get ready for our session with him tomorrow right here on Soundcheck. Now, starting next Monday, November 17th, Soundcheck is going all digital. For those of you who listen online or via our podcasts, this may not be a big deal, but if you listen only on the radio, it's going to be a bit of a switch. Instead of listening to us on the air at a specific time, you can find us anytime at soundcheck.org. As always, we'll bring you daily music news, exclusive videos from artists like Idina Menzel, live music streams, playlists, and much more. So if you're not already subscribed to our free podcast on iTunes, now's the time to do it. And follow us on Facebook or Twitter so we can keep you posted about when new things go up on our site. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.